Welcome to the Masterminds podcast channel, brought to you by DonorSearch, a leader in prospect research tools and analytics, and your host, one of America's top philanthropic experts and fundraising consultants, Jay Frost.
Linda Lysakowski is a consultant and master trainer who has been informing and inspiring fundraisers and other nonprofit leaders for decades. The author of 33 books and editor of still more, she has spoken around the world and been honored by many chapters of AFP, as well as being the recipient of the Barbara Marion Award for Outstanding Service to AFP. Linda, what brought you to Nevada?
Well, I think probably mostly the mountains and the desert. About 35 or 40 years ago, my husband and I took a trip out west, and we actually visited, I think, just about every state except Nevada in the west. And we fell in love with the west, and I knew I always wanted to be there someday. So when he retired, he came home one day and said to me, "I think I'm going to retire and move to Las Vegas. Are you coming along?" And since we had been married almost 50 years then, I said, "Yeah, I guess so." But I love the mountains and I love the desert. The desert is a place you either love or hate. There's not much in between. So I'm one of the people who absolutely loves it.
And so that's home now. Where were you before?
I was in Pennsylvania, born and raised there. And you know, most people, when their kids grow up, the kids leave home. But in our case, the kids grew up and the parents left home. But I've started getting some of them to migrate west. So I now have one daughter who lives here in Las Vegas and one daughter who lives in Napa, California. And her son is there and a grandson in Colorado. So I'm slowly moving them out west.
There's a lot of that westward migration, I know, for families, but you have deep roots in Pennsylvania, isn't that right?
I do.
You a member of the Pennsylvania Dutch community? Is that right?
Yes. I'm even though my name is Lysakowski, my husband was Polish, I'm mostly of German descent. So I grew up in Berks County, which is right next to Lancaster County, which is very heavily Pennsylvania Dutch. Well, all that area was. When I lived there, in fact, I think when I was growing up, probably 80% of the people in Berks County were what we used to call WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. They were almost all of German descent. Now the city that I grew up in is probably 80% Latino. So it's had quite a shift in focus over the years, but so when I was growing up, it was really hard to understand diversity because we didn't have much of it. So I kind of learned by getting out and traveling around that there were other people in the world besides German Americans.
And when I think about your trajectory, I think about fundraising, but it sounds like much of your life is really revolved around writing. Is that right?
Well, it has. I actually started writing short stories probably when I was about 10, and I always thought it would be really fun to be a writer, but I started my career. Well, I've had so many careers. I just turned 78, and I'm not sure what I want to be when I grow up. I guess it's time to start thinking about that. But I started, first of all, my first career was raising children. I had five within 7 years. And so I was busy raising a family and then decided to go back to school in my 80s, I guess, in the 1980s, I went back to college and got my degree in 1988 and decided that really I enjoyed the nonprofit world. I was a banker when I went back to school. I spent 11 years in the banking profession. And then I decided that academia was really interesting, and I was getting involved as a volunteer, working on my university's annual business appeal and working on their strategic planning committee. And I thought, oh, this is so much more fun than banking. So I changed careers as soon as I graduated. I sent the president of the university my resume. And I said, if there's any job openings here, I would love to come and work here. It was a Franciscan University in Reading, Pennsylvania. And about 2 weeks after I graduated, I got a phone call that they were in need of an assistant vice president for institutional advancement. So I decided it was time to make a career change. And I loved working in the nonprofit sector. But as I started, I worked in the university and then I worked for a museum. But I really knew, like 2 weeks into this, that I wanted more out of it. So I decided that someday I was going to be a consultant. And then once I became a consultant, I thought, gosh, I'd like to really get out and teach other people more. So I ended up doing a lot of presentations. I was speaker at the international conference and for AFP in 1992 or 93, I guess. And that was what really convinced me I wanted to start consulting. So I started my consulting career. And then I thought, gosh, I got to reach even more people if I would write a book. So I wrote my first book, I believe in, I'm not sure the year, probably 2004. And I decided that writing was so much better because it was leaving a legacy and I could really impart my knowledge to a greater number of people through writing than I could through speaking. So I got hooked, I guess, after that first book. And the next thing you knew, I had 30 some books published.
So that's a tremendous, tremendous number of books since 2004.
Yeah. Well,
do you have any inkling that you wanted to be a writer before that? Had you written as a young person? I mean, what was your introduction to
writing? When I was 10, I used to write short stories. And I always had a very vivid imagination. So I just thought, you know, I wanted to really write something. And I started with what I knew because that made sense to start writing about fundraising. The very first book I published was actually through Wiley, and it was Recruiting and Training Fundraising Volunteers. And my latest book, coincidentally, is a nonprofit quick guide on working with fundraising volunteers. So I guess I started and ended with that, but I'm still not ended. I'm in the process now of writing another book on strategic planning. I've co-authored one book on strategic planning already. But I'm doing a series of these quick guides. They're very easy reads. They're short books. They focused in on one particular topic. Like this one's going to be on running a strategic planning retreat. So a lot of them are really focused on one specific area. And I didn't want to focus on volunteers in general because my expertise was in fundraising volunteers. So some of them are pretty narrow subjects. Others, like Fundraising for the Genius, cover soup to nuts. I mean, it starts out with what is philanthropy and why do nonprofits even need to raise money, and takes you through every step of who does the fundraising and how they do fundraising. And it goes from everything from special events and grants through planned giving. And there's a chapter on just about every aspect of fundraising in that book. So I just love to write. It's really challenging. And lately, I've had a new sideline. This is why I said I'm not sure what I want to do when I grow up. But because of my experience in writing, I've had a number of people call me and say, can you help me get my book published? How do I go about it? And I've published with traditional publishers, and I'm also self-published. So I was pretty familiar with both those aspects. And I recently helped a friend of mine who's a Catholic sister publish a book of poetry. And then I helped another friend who's a marriage and family therapist publish a little book that she put together quite a while ago, but wanted to really get it published and out there on Amazon. And I'm currently working with some other people who are publishing books, trying to help them get it started. So To me, I think everybody should write at least one book in their life. You don't have to all write 30, but I just feel like it's such a great way, not only expressing yourself, but helping others. And it's, to me, it's a legacy that I leave. One of the biggest thrills I think I've had is when somebody contacts me that I've never met before, so either through email or by phone, and they say, oh, I have your book, The Development Plan, or whatever it happens to be. And it's all dog-eared and highlighted. And that book just changed my life. And I thought, well, what greater feeling is that than know that you've really influenced someone through your writing of things that you kind of take for granted that everybody knows, but they don't. So it's been really thrilling for me to be able to contribute to the profession in the way that I have.
What's a topic that has been particularly close to your heart? Because you've written a lot of books, but
written a lot for nonprofits, like I said, over 30 now. But a couple of years ago, I decided to write my first novel. It's called The Matriarch. And it's kind of about a woman's spiritual journey. It's a little hard to describe it. It starts with an encounter with a tree, believe it or not. I've always loved trees all my life, in addition to writing. And I fell in love with the bristlecone pine trees when I came out west. They only grow in 6 states in the United States, and they're all out west. And so I wrote a book about a woman having a spiritual experience with this bristlecone pine tree and the different paths that led her. And then that led me into thinking about writing more spiritual books. So I've published several in the spiritual realm. I wrote one called The Face of Jesus, which has a book study guide to go with it for book clubs. And right now people are doing virtual book clubs with it. And then I wrote one based on probably my one and only poem that I've ever written. That was 40 some years ago. One day I was looking at this poem and I thought I should turn that into a book. So I did. And that also has a study guide. And I'm right now currently working on another spiritual book called Crown of Thorns. And then I wrote a travel book because when my husband retired and we moved out to Nevada, we've always loved traveling and we've been to several countries, but my husband always said, there's so much to see in this country. Let's try to really get to see as much of it as we can. And so we traveled a lot around rural Nevada and California and Arizona and Utah. And so I wrote a travel book called Beyond Las Vegas, Road Trips from A to Z. And the premise behind this was a lot of people come to Las Vegas and now all they think of is casinos and shows. And there's so much more to see in rural Nevada and so many interesting little towns that most people never heard of. So it doesn't talk too much about the big glittery parts of Las Vegas. It covers more of the things that you can see out in nature and just interesting little quirky communities. So I'm actually working on a second edition of that now because I realized I missed a lot of things and I wanted to go back. One of the things I'm really fascinated with is there's a gentleman in Dayton, Nevada, which probably nobody ever heard of unless you live in Nevada, but he formed his own country. It's called a mini republic, I guess, the Republic of Malosia. And he's issued his own currency and everything. He's not recognized by the United Nations, but I was just fascinated over what would make someone do that. So that's going to be in my second book. I'm going to make a trip to Dayton, Nevada to check out this Republic of Malosia because I'm kind of intrigued by the whole concept.
It sounds like
I'm going to start my own country, though.
It sounds like you're finding a lot of things to write about. You also talked about how other people all should write a book. What is it that you think inhibits them from doing that? And how do you help them to get over that?
Well, I think a lot of people are not quite sure what to write about. And when I started writing my nonprofit books, I wrote about things that I knew about. and things that I have had experience as a practitioner and as a consultant. And so I've written books about capital campaigns. I've written books about the development plan. I've written books about volunteers and fundraising, board development, because these are some of the areas that I work very heavily in. And I think a lot of times people think that they don't know anything worth writing a book about. And sometimes I have to discourage people because everybody wants to write their life story. And that's a good idea, but unless you're Bill Gates or somebody famous, nobody really wants to probably read your autobiography. And so I've always kind of shied away from that kind of thing for myself. Somebody actually told me after I lost my husband that I should write a book about the journey I had with him and his disease. And I said, no, I'm not ready to write that. And besides, people have enough of their own things to deal with. They don't want to read my story. So I think it's finding something that you feel passionate about, but also that people want to read about. So
how long ago was it that you lost your husband?
2.5 years. And maybe someday I'll write a story about it. But right now, the travel book was sort of my catharsis. I wrote that while he was sick and had it published after he died. But because of most of those journeys we had gone on together, and it was kind of a cathartic experience for me to write about that because it meant so much to us that we were able to travel as much as we were. And we both enjoyed just getting out and getting in the car and driving, and sometimes not even having a destination, but just seeing where the road took us. And so that was kind of it's not really an autobiography, but it's kind of a lot of my own personal experiences. And I think all of an author's books have something of himself in it. Especially my novel had a lot of myself in it, and all the books I've written it, I felt like had a lot of my personal experience in it.
Now, you mentioned working with a good number of authors, and that has not just been recently helping them to find their voice and their book and bring it to press, but also over the years with Charity Channel Press, you were doing acquisitions editing as well.
Right. I was doing acquisitions editing and some comprehensive editing too. In fact, one of our authors is getting ready to publish a second edition of his book. So I'm really excited about working with him. I don't know if you know Stephen Myers. He wrote what I think is really a game-changing book called Personalized Philanthropy. And he's going to publish a second edition with a new chapter in it and some other possible changes to it. So I'm working with him right now on getting that. But I've always loved that. He brought the book to me and I said, this book is great, but you should start out with this concept because it's so powerful. So he rewrote the book and changed it around. And I think it's one of the greatest contributions to philanthropy. I know American College is using it as a textbook, and I think some other schools are too. So I love working with people like that. And because of the amount of writing I did, a lot of people would come to me and say, well, I was thinking about a book on this. What do you think? And then sometimes we'd end up co-authoring the books, or sometimes I would just suggest to people, if it wasn't a field I was really an expert in or interested in, I would just suggest that they write it. And I think everybody has something that they're really good at, but a lot of people, I think, get terrified by the very thought of writing a book because some people think it requires a lot of discipline, and it does to some degree. But every writer I have found is really different. I know one of the Charity Channel authors that I worked with said she disciplined herself that every night she would write. She said, if I wrote a page every night at the end of the year, I'd have a 365-page book. And so that's, some people work really well like that when they do set aside a time. It says, okay, from 6 to 7 p.m., I'm going to write, or I'm going to write after my kids go to bed at night, or I'm going to write first thing in the morning. I personally have to write when I'm inspired to write. And I sometimes will sit and write, you know, two or three chapters at a time. And then I don't touch the book for a week. And then I come back and reread those and then decide where to go next. So I think you have to understand your own writing style and your own style of being disciplined and being maybe put into a routine schedule that you follow rigidly, or just doing things when you're inspired to do them.
Now, you've worked on a lot of books. You've written a lot of books of your own. There are a lot of books in fundraising.
Yes. When I entered this field, there were, I think, a half a dozen books. That's how old I am and how long I've been around.
What now, hasn't been written yet? What are you looking forward to reading? What would you like to see?
Oh, well, probably what I haven't seen too much of is, I'm trying to think, maybe a book on just like kind of organizing your development office and hiring the right staff people. I think that's really important. And that's a book that I think would be valuable to people on how to hire staff, because that's quite a challenge for many nonprofit organizations. Both fundraising staff and executive directors, they're not sure which direction they go. And I find a lot of people fall into jobs and then say, what am I doing here? Right. And maybe their boards or their bosses are saying the same thing. So I think a book on how to hire the right person would be really an interesting one to read.
In your own writing, you've been pursuing all these different topics as they become more and more interesting to you. That seems to mirror your own philanthropy. When we were talking separately, you mentioned that as a volunteer, the things that you're most involved in as a volunteer end up becoming the greatest recipients of your, not just your time, but your philanthropy, especially your church and AFP, where you've been involved for a long time. What is the unique nature of your relationship to your church, and why is that so important to you and so important to write about?
Well, I think the church has always been, I grew up as a Lutheran, which most people in my community did, because most German Americans in my community, at least, were Lutherans. And then I converted to Catholicism at the age of 16. And this was pre-Vatican II. I'm really old. But the church meant a lot to me because it was just, yeah, first of all, I believe very strongly in the theology of the Catholic Church. And secondly, I believe very much the church is a community. And without community, I think we're really lost. One of the things that has struck me, I found a parish out here in Las Vegas. It took us a year to find a church because most of the churches, and the Catholic churches at least in Las Vegas, are very large. They might have 10,000 families. 5,000 families is considered a fairly small church. Mm-hmm. But I found one with 500 families, which is about the size of the church I came from in Pennsylvania. And I've always believed that church is really a community of people, and they're there to support each other and to be there when somebody needs them. And one of the things that I have found out during this virus pandemic that we're all facing is how much the church has meant to me. And, you know, even though you're in a small church, you never know everybody in the church. But I've gotten to meet people over the last year that I never even knew before. I maybe would see them in church once in a while and just wave to them and say hello. But I've gotten to know people because we're involved in, my one friend and I decided early on in the pandemic, we would sort of create a little ministry of our own where we would contact widows who felt comfortable meeting in the park, where we were outdoors and wearing masks and everything, and just meet and sit and talk. And then it kind of emerged, it became more than widows. It became widows, widowers, married people, single people. And we just started meeting in very small groups and got to know each other better. So to me, I look at all the positive sides of the pandemic. I know a lot of people are depressed right now, and suicide rates are up, and domestic violence rates are up. But I think there's a lot of positive outcomes of this. And for me, one of them has been to grow closer to my church. And our church has stayed very active. Of course, there was a period of a couple of months where we couldn't attend Mass at all. So we had to watch it on live streamed on our computer, or some people watched Masses on TV if they didn't have computers. But I felt like this thing really brought our community much closer together. And I think in some ways it's done the same thing for the nonprofit community too. I think a lot of people have found ways that they can participate virtually in some things. And it also brought me closer to my family, because we're scattered in 4 time zones, and I think about 8 states right now. And what I've seen is my kids got this brainstorm idea that since I use Zoom all the time, they said, let's get on Zoom and play games, because they were all getting bored being at home all the time. Sure. So we started playing things like Pictionary and some other games online. And now there for a while. We were on almost every day. It's kind of tapered off a little bit, but at least a couple times a week, I'm on Zoom with my family, and we just get to see each other and talk to each other. And it's better than making a phone call to one and then a phone call to another one. This way we all get together. And on Thanksgiving Day, we're going to have a Zoom chat where everybody gets on at we picked 11:30 Pacific time, so it wouldn't be too late for the East Coasters and the Central time and the Mountain time people. And we're just going to get on and talk and share with each other. And we haven't been together as a whole entire family, I think, since my husband's funeral. That was probably the last time we were all together, because they're so scattered. So I think, you know, it's kind of rambling from this topic of my church life, but I've been involved in church ministry to the nursing homes, because my husband spent 4 years in a nursing home before he died. And so some other people from my church and I were all going in person and doing a communion service every week. Well, of course, when the pandemic struck, we weren't allowed to visit. And I thought, oh my gosh, those people really need to see human faces and interact. So since no one else in this ministry had the capability to do this, I've now taken on the responsibility of doing a virtual communion service. I record it and send them the link, so they have that contact with people that they know and people they're familiar with. So, and I've also been able to recruit a bunch of people from my church to do cards and letters and notes and drawings and artwork and everything else that I take to distribute to all the nursing homes in our community. I live in a small community, but it's a very old community, meaning old in population. And so we have 5 nursing homes, even though it's a town of 17,000 people. So that to me means a lot, because I know what it would have meant to my husband if he were alive and not able to see people. He would have been devastated. And I know these people are really hurting. And I'm now looking into seeing if we can do something for prisoners, because they're in the same predicament. They're, you know, in prison, and at least out here, the prisons aren't open for visitors either right now, because they have a pretty high instance of coronavirus in the prison system. So I'm trying to figure out what we can do for the prisoners, because they also are alone a lot now and not able to have that human contact that they had in the past. So those kind of things to me are important. I know how terrible it is to be lonely. And I think a lot of people really need someone to reach out to them. So that's why I got so involved in my church.
And as you said, nonprofits can play that role. Maybe some are viewing this time as an opportunity to reach out to people, but that's not universal, is it?
I don't think so. I think a lot of people don't realize, they concentrate on their own problems. And yes, we all have problems. And I'm not negating the fact that, you know, some people, especially people living alone, are concerned about their health. But I think most people that I have found really do care about each other. So, and I think the nonprofit community, some are hurting financially because, and I've lost some clients because they had to close their doors really during this pandemic and could no longer afford to pay staff or consultants. So I know one of my clients had to lay off 2/3 of their staff, and now they're open a few days a week, but not every day like they used to be. So I think it's hard for organizations to adapt to this, but the organizations that I think are going to come out of this in the long run and really be stronger than they were before are the ones who pay attention to their clients and pay attention to their donors and pay attention to their volunteers and stay in touch with those people and let them know that they're still there, that they still care. I have one client that was a counseling service, and they're doing all telemedicine now. And it's wonderful that people still have the ability to get on and talk to someone else, because I think there's so much of that needed today that some people feel like they just don't have anybody to talk to. And so these nonprofits that deal with those kind of issues really need our support right now. Things like domestic violence. I've worked with a lot of domestic violence groups, and I know that their cases are up since this virus and everybody's at home now. So I think those kind of organizations really need our support in any way we can give it to them.
And that would also seem to suggest those organizations need to reach out to people to let them know they need that help.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think let them know that they're still there. Let them know that they're still working, and maybe they're working differently now, or maybe not as much as they were, but letting them know that they need help and not begging for help, but just making that strong case for support that, hey, you know, we have more people now that need us than ever, and so we need to raise more money. I've seen some really terrible appeals. One appeal I got through social media was from an organization that said, we had to cancel our big gala, and if we don't raise $400,000 and then next week, we're going to close our doors. Well, you know, I'm not going to give because you need money. I'm going to give because you're helping people. I want to know what you're doing to help people, not just that you need money. That's not a good enough case for support to tell people that you need money. Every nonprofit needs money. So I think the ones that do the really outreach and tell people what they're doing and they still need the funds, but this is what we're doing with it, and this is why we need it, and this is how your money is going to make a difference in someone's life. I think those are the organizations that are really going to come out of this whole thing ahead of the game.
You've described yourself to me as an optimist.
And I am. I'm the eternal optimist.
Now, that doesn't mean you have a crystal ball, but if you look ahead and you imagine what the other side of this whole pandemic looks like for all of us, but particularly for the nonprofit field and for those of us in resource development, what does that look like? What is it? What does a better world, and not just a norm, the old normal, but a better world look like?
To me, a better world means that nonprofits really take their work seriously, that they really get behind this and know what help they're doing. And just when you talked about development people, I thought, you know, even way before this pandemic, when I took my first job in the nonprofit sector, I was working for a university, and I made it a point at lunchtime, we had a faculty dining room, and we had a student's dining room, and I always ate with the students because I wanted to know what the students were getting out of their experience here, because that's how I could translate it to donors and say, you know, I was talking to a student the other day, and he's the first person in his family to ever go to college, and he wouldn't be there without this grant, this scholarship that he got. So I think that development people really need to get out and talk to their program people and find out what's going on in their organization, because sometimes they're hired and they're told, well, your job is raise money, just go out there and raise the money. But if you don't know what you're raising the money for, and if you don't feel passionate about what you're raising money for, I don't think you'll ever be successful in this field. I've always told both people looking for jobs in development and boards and executive directors that want to hire a development person, that to me, the most important quality that you look for is somebody that has passion for your mission. And even as a consultant, I find it really hard to work for an organization if I don't feel some passion for what they're doing. Now, luckily, I have a lot of different passions, so that opens me up to a world of clients. But as a consultant, some people really are passionate about education. So maybe they only want to work with educational institutions, and others might be passionate about healthcare, and that's where they should look for a career. So I think coming out of this, and I do think we're going to come out of this pandemic in 2021. I'm very optimistic, and I hope it's earlier, sooner rather than later. But I think the organizations that are going to really be stronger coming out of this are the ones who take the time now, while they have time, to look at their mission and look at their vision and look at their strategic plan and really look at their values and look at what they're doing in the community, and not just get caught up in putting out fires every day. And sadly, a lot of nonprofits are understaffed, and they feel like that's all they do is run around and put out fires all day long. But I think this is a perfect time for me, for those organizations to sit back and say, okay, what are we doing? And, you know, why do we do what we do? And how needed are we in this community? And maybe some organizations aren't needed as much. Maybe they should think about mergers or acquisitions or closing their doors and letting somebody else do that job. But if you really have a strong enough mission and vision, I think you need to take the time now to examine that and to make sure everybody in your organization feels like they're not just coming to do a job every day. They're there because they really care about what you're doing, which doesn't mean that you should underpay them by any chance. That's not what I'm saying. Somebody can have the passion, but they still deserve to be paid a reasonable salary because they're doing work that helps their community. So I think this is a perfect time for people to really take a look at themselves and say, what do I need to learn more about to be more effective in my job? And how can I learn this without traveling, without risking, you know, the big crowds and those type of thing. So I really encourage people. I'm a big proponent of lifelong learning. I mean, I'm still taking classes and courses, and I think I must be crazy. But
what are you studying now?
Well, right now I've been taking mostly just things through different conferences. I attended an excellent conference on restorative justice, which was sponsored by the Catholic Mobilizing Network and the University of San Diego and the Diocese of San Diego. And I learned a lot about restorative justice and how important that is. I'm actually thinking about taking Spanish in my spare time. I don't have a whole lot of that, but I have always thought I wanted to learn Spanish, especially because my family is very diverse. I didn't really get a chance to tell you too much about my family, but if you indulge me a little bit, I think I might have mentioned that there's 37 of us in my immediate family, and that includes 5 children, 9 grandchildren, 13 great-grandchildren, and 1 great-great-grandson, in addition to, you know, spouses of family members. And my family is very diverse. Out of my 13 great-grandchildren, only 3 of them are Caucasian. And several of them, quite a few of them are Latino. So I thought I should really learn Spanish. And I said I was going to do that when my first Spanish great-grandchild was born. And he's now a grandfather or a father himself. So I really have kind of neglected pursuing that. But one of these days, I'm going to learn Spanish.
One of the questions that we're asking a lot of people right now, because it's been such a tough year, is if they're finding gratitude in any new places, is there something you're particularly grateful for?
Well, I think I'm grateful really for the experience to be able to minister to people like widows and people in nursing homes. And as I said, I think that's a source of gratitude for me. And of course, I'm really grateful for my family. Although they're spread out, they stay in touch with me and come and visit me. And especially while my husband was sick, they spent a lot of time visiting him and visiting me. And I, for a while, my granddaughter suggested I come and live with her when we knew we weren't going to have my husband very much longer. And so I'm really grateful for my family, because I talked to so many people who are disenfranchised from their own family members. And I think that must be the saddest thing, to not relate to your own children or your own siblings. And I'm really grateful for the fact that I have my five children all get along great with each other. There's no, I mean, every family has issues, but there's no discord within the siblings or anything like that. And they all are really, so they turned out to be such great loving people that I'm really grateful for that. So I think my family and my church are probably the two biggest things I'm grateful for. But I'm also grateful for my clients that I've had. And one of the things about being a consultant that I've always loved was the fact that I get to learn so much from my clients. And I've had such a diversity of clients. On the faith-based side, I've worked with the Moravian Church, the Unitarian Universalist Church, synagogues, Catholic churches. And on the social service side, I've worked with domestic violence groups and groups that mentor children of prisoners. And it's just such a wide variety of groups that I've worked with that do such wonderful work in the community. And I'm grateful for what they've taught me, because I think when you are a consultant, you probably learn as much from your clients as they learn from you. At least I've found that to be true. And so, you know, I've worked with arboretums and environmental groups and some arts groups and museums. And it's just amazing to me the good work that's being done out there in the community. And to be a part of it, to me, has been a real sense of gratitude that I have for this profession. And I have to say also for AFP, because that's where I learned just about everything I know about fundraising, was through AFP, either going to conferences or meeting colleagues. And I'm still friends with many of the people I've met through AFP, even though I don't get to see them too much physically anymore. But it's a great way to just get to meet people who share your passion for philanthropy. And to me, there isn't a greater profession. I remember at one international conference, we had Desmond Tutu speak, and he described fundraising as being a noble profession. And that's just has stuck in my mind for a long, long time. And I think he was right. I don't think there is a more noble profession. Right now, maybe it's the frontline healthcare workers. They certainly have a noble profession. But without fundraisers, we wouldn't be able to fund some of these hospitals and nursing homes and people like that that are dealing with the situation now. So I think we as fundraisers have a lot to be proud of.
Thank you very much, Linda. Really appreciate it. The Masterminds podcast is underwritten by DonorSearch, the world leader in donor intelligence solutions for not-for-profit organizations. Our producer is Terrence Diggs. Our theme music is composed and performed by Ahmad Ibrahim. The voice introduction to our program is performed by Ryan Ibrahim. You can subscribe to the Mastermind series on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find blogs, livecasts, and flash classes with our featured masterminds at donorsearch.net or check the show notes and descriptions.